Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ari Critchever, registration 37780. I represent the appellant Roger Cadell. And in my opening brief, I presented five issues for the court's consideration. I'd like to focus my argument today on the first issue involving the Confrontation Clause. I'm happy, of course, to answer questions about any of the issues, but I'd like to begin at least with the confrontation issue. And with that issue, I'd like to begin with the standard of review, because there was some dispute about whether this issue was preserved or not. When this issue arose at trial in regards to two different witnesses, at the time that defense counsel was questioning the witnesses and the district attorney objected, as a first note, the trial attorney was not permitted to make any argument at that time. When the trial attorney was eventually permitted to make an argument about that issue, the trial attorney argued that the cross-examination went to the witness's motive and bias. And it's my assertion that that is sufficient to preserve a Confrontation Clause issue. And
is there a case that supports your position on that?
I was not able to find a case in Colorado, but there is the Martinez case out in the New Mexico Court of Appeals. I can give you the cite for that.
Is that cited in your brief?
It is, yes.
Okay, that's fine.
Yes.
So it seems, Mr. Critchever, that your position is that any time you basically say that a defendant was improperly limited in his or her ability to cross-examine, that necessarily raises a Confrontation Clause claim as well. Is that correct?
I think that's exactly what the Confrontation Clause is designed to protect. And what I wanted to point out is that the cases that the Attorney General cites to for the contrary position, it's clear in those cases that the trial attorney was in fact making an objection on some other grounds, like hearsay. Here, the trial attorney argued that the cross-examination went to the witness's motive and bias. I'm not sure what else we're arguing about if not our right to cross-examine a witness under the Confrontation Clause.
Well, the courts have held that not every challenge to a limitation on cross-examination is also a Confrontation Clause challenge. Is that correct?
I think that's fair.
So what have they said is the difference between a garden variety cross-examination claim and a Confrontation Clause claim?
I think the difference is in looking at what the objection or what the argument could have been. And again, in the cases that the Attorney General cites, it's clear in those cases what the objection was. It's a hearsay objection. It's an evidentiary objection. Here we're talking about motive and bias. We're talking about the witness's credibility. I just don't know what else we're talking about if we're not talking about the Confrontation Clause. And obviously, we didn't use sort of the magic words constitution or confrontation. I don't know that that's necessary, because I think it's obvious from arguing that we want to cross-examine a witness as to their motive and bias that we're talking about our constitutional right to do so.
How, as I recall, the cross-examination was primarily a criminal record.
That's correct.
How does that go to motive and bias?
There were two pieces of cross-examination, and one of them we were allowed to get into. And the first one was both witnesses had a lengthy criminal history, and we were allowed to get into that. And the other piece was what our Supreme Court referred to as the witness's specific bias, which is information from which you could infer that they had a motive to bend the facts or, you know, color their testimony in this case. I think the Merritt versus People case draws a distinction between evidence of a witness's general credibility and evidence of a witness's specific bias. And a witness's criminal history goes to their general credibility, their, you know, general inclination to tell the truth or not. Here we have information that goes to their specific bias. We have Mr. Spangler, who took a deal in exchange for his testimony in this case, and we weren't allowed to elicit that information.
Let me ask you that, counsel, and first to make sure, your argument here is that you got to ask about the general bias in the criminal record to attack credibility. You were not permitted to ask about the specific bias.
That's correct.
Correct. And the specific bias here really is that these folks got deals for the testimony they were giving.
And very, and as to Mr. Spangler, a pretty good deal.
Okay. Could I, and you, I think you were just about to go here, but I would like you to address very specifically the whatever record you made or offers of proof as to what the deals were both with Ms. Burgess and Mr. Spangler.
With Mr. Spangler, again, when we were eventually permitted to make a record, we informed the court that at the time of his testimony, he was serving two consecutive sentences. In exchange for his testimony in this case, the district attorney was going to file a motion asking that his sentences be modified to be concurrent sentences. This is a huge benefit to Mr. Spangler.
And it was specifically tied to the testimony in this case?
That's correct. And the court apparently thought that the issue of the concept of consecutive versus concurrent was too confusing for the jury to understand. And I'll leave that. The record on for Ms. Burgess is a little less clear. We were able to elicit that her criminal history. We were able to elicit that she was on diversion in Jefferson County. And there's this whole issue with her using her sister's name when she reported the vehicle stolen. And she kind of disappeared after that. And the only way that she was located was from the Denver District Attorney's Office through the Jefferson County District Attorney's Office, who operates the diversion program in Jefferson County. And we then begin to ask her about her conversations with the Jefferson County District Attorney's Office as it relates to securing her presence to testify in this trial. And that's the point where we get cut off. And admittedly, our offer of proof is not as clear as it was regarding Mr. Spangler. But I think from where the questions were going, it's pretty clear where we were going. We're asking her, what did she get in exchange for her testimony in this case?
Well, was there any factual basis to believe she got something or just kind of taking a shot at it?
Yeah, there's nothing in the record specifically about that. There's really two pieces going on with her. One is whether or not she maybe was getting some benefit from her testimony. And there's also this discussion about the plea agreement that she entered, which landed her in the diversion program. And part of that plea agreement was she had an additional case dismissed, which we were also not allowed to talk about, which is just additional evidence to demonstrate her willingness to cooperate with the district attorney's office. As I said before, I think that this case is strikingly similar to the situation in Merritt, where we similarly had two witnesses where the trial attorney was permitted to cross-examine them about their criminal histories and was not permitted to cross-examine them about the benefit that they received from testifying in that case. And that's exactly what we had here. We have two witnesses who we were not permitted to inquire as to their specific bias and the benefit that they received for testifying in this case.
Would you agree with me that there might be a distinction here in the application of Merritt as between Spangler and Burgess? Spangler, in Merritt, there was a use immunity issue. Everybody knew about these witnesses got use immunity. Here, we know, at least based on the offer of proof, Spangler seemed to get something directly for testifying. Or less, by your own candid admission, we don't know. We don't have the same kind of facts on Burgess.
Yeah, I think I have to admit that the record as to Ms. Burgess is not as clear. But again, I think from where the direction that those questions were going, I think it's fairly apparent, at least what we were trying to get out of her.
Do you see a distinction? Let's just look at Ms. Burgess. Is your argument Merritt applies equally, even though you didn't have as firm a factual basis?
I think so, because the information that we're trying to get out of her was still in the same category of information. It was still, you know, the same distinction. General credibility came in, specific bias did not. And what was particularly troubling to me was the reason that it didn't come in. The trial court apparently decided that there's apparently some threshold of information, and once the jury has heard, you know, X numbers of prior felonies, then that's enough information. And apparently thought that, you know, that was sufficient. And I'm not sure where the court gets that legal standard from, but that's a bit troubling to me, that the court says, oh, you know what, the jury's heard enough, the jury gets it. The jury gets that they have lengthy criminal histories, and so I'm cutting off anymore. That's simply not the legal standard.
Mr. Critchover, with regard to Mr. Spangler's testimony, if we were to agree with your argument that the trial court should have allowed more cross-examination, what is your basis for asserting that it's reversible error as opposed to harmless or harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
The standard for under the Confrontation Clause, as our Supreme Court announced in Kinney, is that it's not an outcome determinative standard. In Kinney, and I can put my finger on this on the language. The error is prejudicial when a reasonable jury would have had a significantly different impression of the witness's credibility had the defendant been allowed to pursue the desired cross-examination. So the focus is not on the outcome of the trial, which I think differentiates the Confrontation Clause from other constitutional issues in that our focus is on the witness.
Well, here Mr. Spangler had been impeached with his evidence of his prior felony conviction.
That's correct.
Right? So doesn't it become then a question of how much more might he have been impeached if the trial court had allowed this question as opposed to not allowing this question?
I think that's probably the right question, which takes us directly into the merit case, where the court said there is a distinction between general credibility and specific bias, and in merit, where they were permitted to cross-examine on the general credibility but not permitted to cross on specific bias, that was reversible. And that's exactly the situation that we have here.
Mr. Critchover, if I can follow up on Judge Taubman's question. Mr. Spangler was the owner of the vehicle, right?
One of the owners.
I mean, wasn't the principal purpose for his testimony to say, I didn't authorize the defendant to take the vehicle?
Yes.
The defendant never disputed that, though.
That's correct.
Right, so why, assuming that's the principal purpose for Mr. Spangler's testimony, I didn't give him permission, and the defendant doesn't deny that, even assuming there was error in not allowing the cross, what difference does it make?
I have two responses to that. And the first one is similar to my response to Judge Taubman's question, in that the standard, that's simply not the standard as the Supreme Court announced in Kinney. The standard is we need to focus on the witness and whether the jury would have had a significantly different impression of that witness's credibility. In addition
that's
to
what
that,
I'm getting at. The principal sure. fact is not disputed.
That's correct. What we weren't allowed to get into, I think that there was more there. And I understand we didn't make an offer of proof about what else might have been there, but I think that there is something that there was something left unsaid. Here's a witness who comes forward, whose testimony appears to be pretty, you know, unimportant, and yet he receives a pretty favorable deal in exchange for his testimony. And we aren't allowed to pursue any of that about the deal, about why he got the deal, about what he might be leaving out of his testimony in exchange for his deal.
Were you, through disclosure, aware of what the deal was?
In terms of
what the deal was with Mr. Spangler, did the DA tell you what the deal was?
I'm not sure where that information came from, but you know, we did present to the court that the trial attorneys.
My question is, how would you know what the deal is unless you asked the witness? If the DA is not required to disclose deals made with witnesses, and you're not given normally access to those witnesses prior to trial, how other than by cross-examination can you determine if there was a deal and what it was?
I think that's exactly where I'm headed. And if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my little time for rebuttal.
You have 30 seconds left, Mr. Pritchard.
Morning. My name's John Seidel, bar number 17633, representing the people in this case. First point I want to make is that people disagree with the notion that reference to cross-examining for motive and bias necessarily preserves a claim that evidence is required or the cross-examination is required to under the Constitution. In our view, the defendant in this matter should have and was required to expressly say that the Constitution required the cross-examination that he wanted to get into. It's one thing to say, well, what I have to offer is relevant or goes to motive and bias. Well, that says that the cross-examination, proposed cross-examination, is relevant to motive and bias. It does not say the Constitution requires that I get into this. And there's lots of ways to get evidence in. Statutes, rules, judicial doctrines like opening the door and the Constitution. Expressly saying that evidence is relevant to a matter at issue does not mean it is constitutionally required to be admitted.
And Mr. Critchever said there were no Colorado cases on this issue, but cited to us in the New Mexico case. What cases would you support in favor of your position?
I have two sort of lines of authority. The first one is just basic preservation law. If you look at the case called V. Hill that was cited at pages 8 and 9 in our brief, our own Supreme Court said that a hearsay objection doesn't preserve a constitutional confrontation claim. And another case more general out of this court was the McNeely case, where this court said a constitutional, that at the trial level, a defendant must surely present a constitutional claim. That was not done here. It's not, the trial court was not surely alerted to the confrontation or the constitutional nature of the evidence. And the other line of authority I wanted to talk about was the notion that the line of authority that says, look, once you have a basic cross-examination on matters relating to credibility, it is up to the trial court to limit cross-examination under the balancing test of CRE 403. In other words, the trial court has to provide cross-examination that satisfies the confrontation clause, but it need not allow the defendant to go, it doesn't allow unlimited cross-examination.
Well, how do you distinguish Merritt, Mr. Seidel?
To be honest with you, Judge, I have not read Merritt, so I'm not going to be able to distinguish that case on its facts.
Okay, let me just help, because I really would like an answer. So Merritt basically said it was error for the court to not allow cross-examination where two witnesses were given use immunity on the theory that they got a deal for testifying. There was, as I recall the case, the defendant was allowed to talk about prior criminal history, just like in this case, to kind of show lack of credibility, but the court cut off the testimony on use immunity. And that was held to be error. It seems to me, Mr. Critchever has cited the record. Here, we got the category of challenge to credibility. That was allowed. So where the cross got cut off was asking these two witnesses, Ms. Spangler, Ms. Burgess and Mr. Spangler, about deals for their testimony. If, assuming I've recited Merritt correctly, why doesn't Merritt apply here, and why wasn't it an error to allow the defendant to cross-examine on those issues?
Okay.
If they got a deal to testify.
I think Merritt, from your reading of it, Your Honor, Merritt was a case in which cross-examination into specific bias, as it's termed, was completely cut off. That is not the case here. What we have here is a case where the trial court allowed some cross-examination into specific bias, but cut it off when the trial court exercised its discretion to not permit cross-examination that would essentially, what it believed would confuse the jury and raise collateral matters.
What testimony was allowed or came in regarding deals that these two witnesses got specifically to testify?
Let me first talk about Mr. Spangler, because I disagree with the contention raised by the other side that the evidence was offered that Spangler would got a deal to testify in this case. My reading of the record is once the, at the time where the record was made on this, the defense said, well, they have moved to reduce or change one sentence to another, a consecutive sentence to a concurrent sentence. That's all there was on that point, and I believe, first of all, prior to that, Spangler had testified that he had several convictions. And it was, in my mind, I remember it being rather confusing as to what convictions were currently being served, what were over. He said a couple, one or two sentences were had finished. There was some testimony that one was consecutive, but there's also in the next, on the same page, he said, that sentence is over. So it's not at all clear what sentences he's serving. Now, there's at the time, later on, when they're making their record, the defense says, well, they've moved or they want to seek a reconsideration and drop one from consecutive to concurrent. Well, nobody ever said who they is, whether it's the defense or the prosecution, nor did the defense counsel offer proof of that. And more specifically, there was no indication from my recollection of the record and in my notes that reduction had anything to do with his testimony in this case. I just don't see it.
Well, isn't, if you look at volume, isn't that precisely the questioning that they weren't allowed to do? You're saying it's kind of a chutzpah argument. They weren't allowed to ask the question. You said they don't have the evidence because they couldn't ask the question.
It seems to me that if they're going to come up and say they are going to move to dismiss the or reduce a sentence because, you know, if they know about that, they ought to be able to say, well, and it's in connection with this case. I mean, lots of guys move to reduce their sentences or get them changed from consecutive to concurrent. What I'm saying is they at least have to offer proof or at least say we want to establish that this that is going to be granted or that there's a possibility that it will be granted conditioned on this testimony. Now, it seems to me that if they had at least offered to or said that's where we're going with this, that might be a different story, but that's not what they said.
Counsel, I might be more closely agreeing with you if there was any way for them to know what deals were made, if any.
Well,
and my understanding is there's no requirement to disclose that, and the only way they can get that information is by cross-examination. And it may not be efficient, but it may ultimately be effective.
Your Honor, I would say that the defense, first of all, I'm not sure I agree with you about the discovery. I don't know the answer to that question right off the top of my head. It seems to me that the prosecution is required to disclose impeaching information because that's considered exculpatory. And so if the prosecution had made a deal with a witness, they might have to disclose it. But that, setting that aside, I think the defense could have done more to show where it was going. Now, having said that, it seems to me that even if the offer that they had wanted to get into the consecutive versus concurrent sentencing, I think the trial court properly said the probative value of that is too low and the risk is too high that Spangler couldn't explain adequately the difference between consecutive and concurrent sentencing. Now, remember, the trial court's the only one here that sees the guy on the stand and can assess whether he's going to be able to get the ideas across about the differences or not without fumbling around and confusing the jury. Now,
if I could come back for just a second to the distinction between an ordinary cross-examination objection as opposed to a confrontation clause examination. Assume that you were Judge McGahee in this case. What would you do differently if the defendant had specifically said this is a confrontation clause objection?
What would I have done differently?
Right. Does it make it
as the judge?
As the judge. Assuming you were the judge, I just wanted to know, and to rephrase my question, as a practical matter, what difference does it make, if any, if a defendant says this is a confrontation clause objection, as opposed to saying I want to cross-examine this witness about motive and bias?
Because I think that alerts the trial court that it has to say it's not just a matter of its discretion. For example, in Spangler's case, the trial court said, I don't think you need to get into this area because this guy, I'm not sure he could explain the difference between consecutive and concurrent sentences without confusing the jury. That's where the trial court stops. Now, had the constitutional necessity been brought to its attention, it might have said, okay, now I have to decide whether or not, you know, this evidence is constitutionally material. In other words, is it more important that the evidence get across to establish, you know, a bias that's constitutionally required to be admitted, than it is, then do I need to be more concerned with that? Is that more weighty than this business about confusing the jury? Here, the trial court says this is going to confuse the jury, and the defense never says, Judge, this is absolutely essential to get into specific bias.
Let me ask you this, counsel. I have not been into the record. Did defense counsel ask Mr. Spangler if he had been offered anything in exchange for his testimony?
My recollection.
A sentence concession or the dismissal of charges?
My recollection is he did not. There was no questioning along that line.
There was no direct confrontation with the witness about the possibility of a deal.
I think that's right. Now, finally, I wanted to get to the last point I wanted to make, and that is that there was no prejudice here resulting from the trial court's ruling, regardless of whether you think that their offer was sufficient, and even regardless of whether you think that it's a harmless or a plain error standard, whether the error was preserved, in the end, the result will be the same because any error here was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, we know that the test in that case, and for these types of cases, is we assume that the damaging potential of cross-examination has been fully realized. Can the appellate court say that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? In my view, that's what the court should say here. Now, there are several factors that go into that, the importance of the witness testimony, whether that testimony was cumulative, whether it exists, whether it corroborates or contradicts certain evidence, and so forth. Now, here, all of Spangler's testimony was cumulative and corroborated by other witnesses. Therefore, one has to say, well, wait a minute, even if the jury had heard that he's gotten this deal, nothing he testified to was different than anything that somebody else said. For example, the detective Reed testified, along with Burgess, the other witness, and the documents that were admitted showed that Spangler owned the truck. And one wonders, if he owned the truck, why would he be lying about that? Detective Reed clarified or confirmed the value of the truck, which is something that Spangler also testified to. As you pointed out, Your Honor, Judge Gabriel, that the defendant admitted he didn't get Spangler's permission, and the other evidence was, of course, that Burgess never gave him permission. So I would suggest, and that's really all he testified to, I would suggest that, you know, if you look at the cases on limits on cross-examination, this case falls squarely in line with the cases that say, look, even if the jury had gotten this evidence that they say was so important, nothing would have changed. And even if that had affected Spangler's credibility, nothing he testified to, or everything he testified to, was adequately, in fact, overwhelmingly corroborated by other evidence. I'd ask the court to look at the James case, cited on the answer brief at 16, the Gilbert case, cited on the answer brief at page 14. There's a Garcia case, and there's also the Knight case that's cited, I think, in the legal discussion on this point, where the trial court and this court affirmed that said, by saying, look, a trial court can reasonably conclude that inquiry would have triggered sort of a time-consuming, confusing foray into collateral matters and shed no new light on the credibility of the witness.
Mr. Seidel, is your analysis similar with regard to Ms. Burgess's testimony?
I think it's, Judge, I think it's even stronger. There, Burgess had already admitted she was a false reporter, had falsely reported here and in this case, and I think she did that because she wanted to keep her head down and just make it through the adult diversion program. And in fact, she admitted that she'd only been located and brought in to testify in this case through that diversion program. And of course, the defense got to argue exactly what it wanted to argue, that namely, she was under the prosecution's thumb in the Jefferson County Diversion Program case and only appeared here to appease the DA in her case. Now, in my mind, that's fairly speculative, but they got to make the argument. And finally, you know, there's no, as the defense has admitted here, there was no showing that any of the other questions that the defendant wanted to ask would have, we don't know what those questions were. We don't know that she got a deal. There was no suggestion that she did. He never detailed why he wanted to ask her about the specifics of the adult diversion programs, and he never explained what it is he wanted to ask that would have given the jury a significantly different view of her credibility. I would ask that the court affirm, and I thank it for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Seidel. Mr. Preacher, we're going to make sure you have about 30 seconds.
I just want to respond to a couple of points very quickly. The Attorney General spent much of his argument talking about our offer of proof with regard to Mr. Spangler and how it wasn't, what we presented was not clear. I just would submit that I wanted to sort of clear up the record. What we said is, additionally, two consecutive sentences Mr. Spangler is serving. I think it goes to his motive and bias. We are aware that they are changing his consecutive sentence into a concurrent sentence, and then they go into discussion about how they can't do that, but it's about the witness's expectation, not whether the district attorney's office obviously has the authority to actually change the sentences.
Mr. Christopher, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Christopher and Mr. Seidel, both of you, for your helpful arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the oral